Love this podcast? Support this show through the supporter feature from Acast. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Dedicated to Henry Foreman. In the year of the primal war, the dawn of terrestrial birth, man mastered the mammoth and horse, and man was the lord of the earth. He made him an olive skin from the heart of an olive tree. He compassed the earth therein, and man was the lord of the sea. He controlled the vigorous steam, he harnessed the lightning for hire, he drove the celestial team, and man was the lord.
Well, episode 77 of Agitators Anonymous. This is a pretty special one. It's a really interesting chat with Jonas Renske from Catatonia. Before we get into that, over on patreon.com, Alan Averill, you can be a member for a dollar a month. I don't really understand how the tiers work, so feel free to go over and have a look. There's other podcasts, other this and that, songs, rehearsals, etc. The show is sponsored by MetalBlade.com. If you're in North America, use the promo code ALAN to get 10% off your order. And Eisenwald Records, www.eisenton.de and .com in Europe and North America, respectively. Use the promo code ALAN and you will get the very same. Go over and take a look. The links are in the description below. Because this is a video cast, so over on my YouTube channel, you can go and take a look at our ugly old middle-aged mugs and how goth or whatever else we look. Jonas is a thoughtful and introspective guy. This was a very entertaining and enjoyable chat to have. We've had similar versions before and backstages around the place, talking about the old days, the start of the band, why Catatonia kind of stood out. Maybe some of you do not know, but Primordial and Catatonia have a split 10-inch from back in 97, 96, 98, something like this. They were in my fanzine back in the early 90s and were always one of my favourite bands back in the day. So we go all the way from the inception of the band, all the way up to the new stuff and the 2000s and all that kind of stuff. But a lot of it is discussing Brave Murder Day, the decisions that were made at the time, Jonas moving from singing to drumming, or vice versa, on all that kind of thing. So here we go. It's episode 77, a chat with Jonas from Catatonia.
Well, sir, how are you doing? All right. We just asked you that before I pressed record, so I actually know, but, you know, let's do it again.
It's all good. I mean, considering.
or else it's not all good, and we'll get into that. So, yeah. you played in Bulgaria 2 weeks ago. What was that like?
Yeah. It was our first show in 18 months. I guess, you know, a lot of bands have that time frame now where they just haven't played a show for a long time. And yeah, we were lucky enough to do a first one after this corona shit that's going on. So that was a relief, and it was kind of magical to be back on stage. So yeah, very nice.
Yeah, we had the same thing, I guess the same 20 months off. And I suppose as we played in Germany maybe 2 weeks ago and then London just before that, and as restrictions began to begin loosened a little bit, so did my stress and tension and aggravation levels, the volume began to be turned down a little bit.
Yeah,
with them. But I found something really very simplistic and sort of kind of almost childlike and joyful in it again. It was weird. It was like not a day had gone by, but also like a reunion after years. And I found we were all just laughing at the same stupid jokes and stuff. That, did you have like a total shit-eating grin when you first stepped back out? It's like, oh yeah, this is what it was supposed to be like.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think we all looked at each other and thinking like, oh, this is what it used to be, you know. And it was a bit surreal, but also a very comfortable feeling because you've done it before.
Yeah.
You obviously had a break from it, but, you know, it was well worth the wait, I would say.
I was thinking about this the last few days, and if anybody who's listened to the podcast knows that I sort of had a lot of sort of, I guess, anger, frustration, and the podcast before, you know, there's the video interviews and then there's the podcast where I sort of ramble over topics. And certainly I felt in the last 6 to 8 weeks a kind of release of some of the pressure. And it's given me a little moment to sort of take stock of the last, what actually is 30 years when I think of it, of having an accidental career. You know, that with Neil and I, we've gone on holiday by accident kind of thing.
Yeah.
Somehow it just happened by accident in all those years. How did it feel for you, the gap? Did you feel like, was it a pause for reflection, or were you just occupied with other stuff? Or I've had quite a bit of introspection in the last month or two of like, my God, it's been 30 years of a career, you know?
Yeah, I've had the same. I had bits of both, actually, because I try to stay creative and try not to, you know, lose focus too much, because I know it's easy that you kind of bury yourself in this whole situation, and it will affect you more than it, you know, needs to be. But
yeah,
at the same time, of course, I mean, Catatonia is this year actually celebrating 30 years. So,
yeah,
of course, this gets to my mind, and you start to look back because you have the time to look back. You're not into a tour schedule or an album recording or, you know, anything like that. So it's kind of overwhelming. And as you say, I regard it just as you do. It's a career that's just by chance, basically.
Yeah.
For me, at least, I don't feel like I was meant to do this. It was just like stepping on a banana skid, and then you're in. You know,
and you just keep slipping down the stairs all the time, and you have.
Yeah, I do. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I'm very much a person who needs something constantly to focus on, and I'm quite wound up and quite full of energy about everything. And the other guys around were just like, "Look, it'll work itself out." I wouldn't, and I'm still not so convinced that all of it will work itself out, but that's a different podcast. But especially once the anger kind of and the frustration subsided a bit, I know what you mean. It just felt like, I think that traditionally a lot of bands, like, who were making big livings and everything, they're in album cycle. But when you're not quite within that, you're a little bit outside that, you do make some money, but sometimes you don't. Sometimes you do in festival season, sometimes you don't. And once you take away the financial terms of it, you kind of realize what a strange and curious way it is to have a sort of like a big long career that is outside of, let's say, mainstream expectations. Do you know what I mean? Like, you must have friends. I had the same for me. As soon as we released an album, they thought you must be making tons of money. And then I have friends who come down here and go, so what have you got? So you don't have a family, you don't have a guitar, or no, you have a guitar, you don't have a car, you don't have an apartment. I go, yeah, but sure, that's just the way it went. And they go, right, you have a career for 30 years, but you never got to buy a house, or, you know what I mean? So it's quite strange how we measure it. But only recently have I really started to realize and measure it and just be like, so kind of, as you say, overwhelmed is a good word, by how much stuff there is there, you know?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it's, you know, as I said, it's by chance, but I mean, for some reason, we're still here. So we must be doing something right, at least, you know, that there must be plenty of bands formed in the same years as our bands that never made it. So apparently some kind of talent or survival skills.
I kind of feel like every band has a different, let's say, character, in the sense that in Primordial, I was the guy who was relentless about my pursuit of pushing everything forward, and I'll sort out the studio, I'll sort out the record label, I'll do the blah, blah, blah. You know, I'll always very relentless, but having probably the least amount of talent, so could say.
Yeah.
who, you know, because you compensate, you have different jobs. Somebody else goes, all right, yeah, the numbers, I'll do the accountancy, I'll do the riffs, I'll do the whatever.
Yeah.
What's your job then?
Do you think? I think it's changed over time, actually, because in the beginning it was always Anders was the, or he's still more of a businessman than I am.
Yeah.
But he was also the you know, the creative force in the band. He was writing the music. Mm. I guess my role in the beginning was more, you know, a little bit more artistic, maybe with the lyrics and the themes and stuff like that. Mm. And over the years, it's continued that way, because these days I write more of the music than I used to do, and Anders is still the businessman. So he was probably what you were back in the day.
I'm not sure I was a good businessman, but I was certainly the one with who's writing all the letters and was sort of relentless in.
Yeah,
let's keep on going, you know. Whereas, yeah, you know,
exactly. I think that was his role as well, because he was very, and he still is very focused on you know, the career of the band and what we should do and what we shouldn't do and stuff like that. While I'm just, you know, trying to go along with whatever's happening, you know.
But when you're writing, then what are you writing on or with, or is it different to Anders's writing, or has it changed since the beginning? Because obviously you moved from behind the drum kit to just singing and stuff, you know.
Yeah, I think in the beginning we used to jam a lot, just me and him, because he was playing the guitar, I was playing the drums, and he always had a bunch of riffs, and we had like a rehearsal room where we could rehearse for a couple of times a week. So it was always like filled with a lot of, you know, new riffs, new ideas, a lot of stuff coming together that way. But these days I do write with my guitar and, you know, he does the same. We don't jam these days because I think we realized early on that we're not that kind of bad, you know, that five guys in a rehearsal room trying to come up with a song. I don't think we're good enough for that. You know, we don't have that.
Why do you think that? Why do you think that? I mean, the human process of the five in the room is what I like. We sort of, in between us, it's a mixture of laziness, Irish refusal to learn new technology, and also stubbornness. We sort of figure that the humanity involved in shouting at each other is part of the process of what makes the edgy part of the band what I like, you know.
Yeah, I know what you mean. We're pretty much the opposite, and sometimes I wish we had more of that, because it, as you say, it gives like an edge to the music, maybe some extra excitement and you know, a soul maybe that we don't really get by writing separately and then just go to the studio, basically. But it's a way that's been working out very well for us the last, you know, 15-20 years, and then of course we get together in the room when it's time for a tour, and we get a little bit of shouting as well, and you know, everything that's also very good with being in a band also comes with that. So it's we get a little bit of both. So we're just trying to balance.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's called, I mean, I think the edge is the bit of humanity, not to be too great to, you know, throw that phrase around, isn't it? Because it's a very big kind of word, but it's the human process of everybody sort of, I might go, well, can we do it in a different key? Or what about that riff from that song 3 years ago? And but when you're, Do you put, obviously, right, you're putting your lyrics to your riffs. What's the process that you go through? Because I'm a bit fascinated by this, of the process of putting your lyrics to somebody else's riffs. Because I find myself with my lyric books on paper. I write on the phone now, which feels weird. But it doesn't feel right till I've written it out on paper. And then I have a, the guys are playing and I have tons of bits of paper everywhere and I'm looking at books and I'm trying to think, I think I wrote a lyric that fits this mood 14 years ago, and I take bits and like, what's like a sort of crazy scientist or something. How do you figure it out though?
These days I only write actually when I have something to write to. I used to do a lot of writing and just keeping stuff lying around like you do on pieces of paper. Scattered. But these days I don't think I have the time really to sit down and write when I don't have to, which is
I started on my phone, which is weird.
Yeah, I do that a little bit, but
it feels weird.
Just trying to if I come up with a sentence or a phrase that I like, I put it down on my phone, but I try to, you know, focus 100% when there is a song that needs lyrics, and then I just go totally into that until it's done. And that, you know, that might take a few days, and but then I feel like this is my task for as long as it takes, until this lyric is 100% to me good enough. And the rest of the time I don't think too much about lyrics, because I'm such a freak when it comes to lyrics and a nerd. It sort of devours me in a little bit, you know. So I try not to focus too much on it when I don't have to, because I'm you know, I'm super. I love lyrics, and it's such a big thing. I don't want to think about it too much, because it becomes a bit too overwhelming. So
yeah, I know what you mean. I mean, I've always been quite sort of wordy and interested in literature or English and stuff. And I do write on the phone, but I don't like the process on the screen. But I do kind of sometimes it's the oddest times. I'll be sitting on like the train or something, and I'll be thinking about something. Like lately, I've been thinking about this phrase, you know, like, what is it? Plowshares to rust, swords to dust, something, blah, blah, blah. I must not be sitting there going, and then I have and then can I really do a little phone or something?
Yeah.
But I try and be, I try and have to have a moment where you just have to release it. You know what I mean? You have to let go. Like the moment where you're recording and you just go, that's got to be the final version of that. I don't. Like, do you keep going back and tinkering with things and fiddling with things?
Not too much, because I, just like you, I think that, you know, at some point you have to say, this is done now.
Yeah.
And this is how it will end up. Because if you go back, you will allow yourself to go back once again and again, and you'll never be finished, and you will be unhappy with the lyrics in the end. So I think it's like with vocal takes. Usually the first one is the best, but you never go for it, because you always think, I can do better, you know. So I try to stay true to that, you know. The initial idea is always, not always, but most of the time, it's the best one.
Yeah, I think you've got to try and go with the vibe of the mood, but also not make it perfect, so to speak. The idea of the albums I loved from the old days had inflections and character and mistakes and things within them. I always was really fascinated with the sort of Manila Rose, Sirith Ungol style of vocals, as well as the Dio's. And I always thought, well, you know, I can be, if I'm somewhere and fall somewhere in between, is some parts where people go, oh, that's a pretty good bit of, you know, diction.
Yeah.
And other parts where you go, oh, well, there's a real Irishism in the word, not allow someone to cut it all out, you know?
Yeah.
But did you find that, because one thing I find about Swedes, though, is because you seem to learn English with an American accent, when you started to sing, did you find that you weren't sure how your voice sounded? Because when I first heard my voice being sung back to me, like played back to me, I was like, what? I'm really, is that really how I sound, making all these, you know, Irishisms? Did you find that?
Yeah, I mean, as you say, we talk with, I would say, you know, Swenglish accent, but it's more leaning towards the American.
Sometimes.
Which is a bit weird, because UK is, and England and Ireland, whatever, it's closer to us.
Yeah.
But it's, I guess, the TVs and the movies and everything that comes from America. So, but I actually know what you mean, because we did once a song in Swedish some years ago, like a B-side thing. And when I heard it for the first time, I was like, is that how I sound? You know, because it has a Stockholm accent, which I'm not aware of when I talk. But when I heard it in the singing, I was like, wow, that sounds, you know, freaky to me.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I know. I definitely know what you mean.
Well, I have quite an anglicized, like a sort of thing. In Ireland, they call it a West Brit, which is an insult.
Okay.
Which means like you're west of Britain.
Okay.
Sort of like a left footer. Oh, that's going to get me into trouble. But it's like, it's sort of, it's an insult that Irish people give people who sound too, you know, I mean, they talk a bit like this in an English accent.
Yeah.
So I get that. So on the first Primordial album, there's a song that's in Irish. And it's, of course, it's me, Marfio Will the Joe, pronouncing it in my.
Yeah.
So I'm trying to be like Lord Byron, sort of,
you know,
with some sort of velvet cloak, but talking Irish. And still to this day, people come up to me and Marfio Will, you know, do the overpronounced Hammer Horror version of it that I did. And the first time I heard it back, I was like, oh, is that really how I sound? And my mates are like, yeah, pretty much.
Yeah. Yeah, you never know until you hear it, and then you go like, wow, that's insane, you know.
Mm.
But it's funny, though, because you, I guess it's pretty much just the same time I heard myself sing with like the death metal voice on a recording, because you've done it in rehearsal room and you can't barely hear yourself and you just scream. And then you hear it in a studio version for the first time, and it's like, whoa, what's going on? Is this me?
Mm.
And that's also some kind of revelation. Like, I can actually do this. And because to me, when we did our demo, it was the first time I would hear myself in that sort of context, when it's something is properly mixed and you can hear the vocals with a little bit of reverb on it, and it sounds like, wow, it's pretty good, you know.
Yeah. Well, let's let's talk about that demo, because that was on my things I wanted to talk to you about. For me, Jehova Elohim Meth, or whoever way we say it, that's like, for me, that's top five demos of that era.
Wow.
That's okay. Like, was a big influence on even Primordial. We started in 91, same, but our demo didn't come out till 93. And so I think that's the end of 92, right? Or start of 93, isn't it?
I think mid, because it was summer when we recorded it. So probably June 92 or something.
Yeah, because I got it from maybe somewhere at the end of 92 and Palace of Frost and all that kind of stuff. And it was one of the first demos with, I think it was done in Unisound, right?
Yeah.
So it just,
but it was called Gory Sound at the
Gory
time.
Gory Sound, yeah. So for me, that's like a top five demo of that period, and I wanted to start, well, I'm going to start, but wanted to talk about that, because it just seemed to perfectly encapsulate that sort of black doom almost feel of the time. But you were just doing that as a two-piece, though, right? What can you tell me about the early, the gory sound kind of thing? Because it seemed like Dan Swano really hit on from there on in, he had a whole bunch of releases and recordings that he hit out of the park for the next 6 or 7 years, you know?
Yeah, I think I was in touch with Dan before, because he was in Edge of Sanity and we really liked Edge of Sanity. So I think I sent him some fan letter and then we stayed in touch. And when it was time for us to do a demo, when we had 3 songs that we thought were good enough, I just called him like you did back in the day. You called on the phone.
Yeah.
And he was like, yeah, come on. So we just went there by train. It's like 2 hours from Stockholm, where he was located back then in Finspång. And, you know, we had zero experience. We had never been in a recording studio ever before.
Yeah.
Anders, who was going to play the bass, he had never touched a bass guitar before.
Yeah.
So I borrowed a bass guitar from a guy in my school that was in some death metal bands. I just asked him, like, do you have a bass? And he's like, yeah, can we borrow it? Yeah. So I brought that, and when it was time to put down the bass on the demo, it was the first time Anders ever held a bass, you know. So, but it, you know, when I think back on it, it's really nice because it was so, you know, underground, and we stayed at Dan's place. He lived in a one room apartment. It was never talk about anything else. Like, where can we stay? We just went there, and he was like, "Yeah, you can sleep on a mattress in my living room." Yeah, and very fond memories of that time and doing that stuff. And I remember coming home, taking the train back home, and I couldn't wait because back then we didn't have like, well, maybe you had a Walkman, but I couldn't wait to get back home to listen to the demo.
Yeah, you had the cassette in your pocket and you were like,
yeah, exactly. And I think I listened to through it like 10 times when I got back home. I just lie down on my bed and it's like, wow, this is us. This is our band.
But you knew, you must have known you were sitting on something though, because like the feeling of listening to demos constantly in rehearsals and whatever. But one of the things that really makes that demo stand out is the tone. The sound is really quite big for a demo of that period.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it's the Paradise Lost influence that, you know, and we were listening to some Marillion stuff, actually.
Marillion?
Yeah, because Anders had seen that they used delay pedal for the guitars and like when doing the lead guitars and stuff.
Yeah.
And I think bands back then didn't really do that. They were just playing fast solos, you know.
Yeah.
But we wanted to, so he bought a delay pedal, and when we brought it with us to the studio, and Dan was like, wow, this is actually the way to go. This sounds amazing. He hadn't really tried that before.
Yeah.
And I think
it makes
that's
sense when you think about it. It makes sense when you think about it, because before that, everybody's playing fast. And so the delay just adds more cavernous noise to something that's fast.
Exactly.
If you're playing slow, you can,
yeah,
you can add that.
And it adds a lot of depth and atmosphere to everything. So we rehearsed, we wrote riffs with that pedal, and it's just made the sound pretty much for us. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think that's one of the key things that made the demo what it is, and also our sound for the future to build on, you know, the whole atmospheric layered whatever. That's just the digital delay pedal.
And the choice at the time to go with the sort of more black metal imagery as opposed to the kind of normal death metal kind of imagery, that always kind of like, because I think I interviewed Anders in 93 for my fanzine back then, and I have all the old photographs of the grotesque shirts and the axes and corpse paint and stuff. And of course, we were doing the same kind of thing because we were tinging more into black metal than kind of doom.
Yeah, I remember.
You guys weren't really fitting into the kind of Stockholm-y death metal sound, you know? So you were sort of doing your own thing there, you know?
Yeah, and I think that's why we wanted to use this... you know, the whole corpse paint thing, we wanted to sort of prove a point that we're a little bit darker because we were listening to a lot of the black metal stuff, and especially Bathory. And at the same time, we had this more maybe UK, British kind of doom metal sound that we wanted also to do. So it was a weird combination maybe, but I think it worked because we... I don't know. We loved both styles. And so we wanted to look the part, and we wanted to sound like something that was, you know, very profound and sorrowful. And
Isn't it strange though? Like I'm a huge fan of the exact same stuff in that, you know, the first My Dying Bride, you know, let's say the God, you know, what is the demo? God Is Alone, Sinfonare. First album and EPs, you know, The Thrash and Naked Limbs. Gothic is top 20 metal albums ever made for me.
Mm.
And not at 18 either. It's a bit further up somewhere, you know?
Yeah.
And Ireland was very close stylistically. Like, you won't find a power metal band from Ireland back then. Everything was kind of gloomy and sodden, you know, sort of had this dark sort of veil drawn up. So we felt a great kinship with early Anathema, you know, all those kind of bands, early Party Sauce. And it was odd because it was like you guys were one of the few bands, you know, not to be surreptitious, but, or if that's the right word, up there, who seemed to sort of get the same kind of vibe, you know?
Yeah.
And it's weird because most people, it's only now in the last couple of years people start talking about it again. I remember being at like parties or, you know, like with people who are a bit younger and you're going, oh, have you ever heard, you know, As the Flower Withers by Modern Bride? You mean I Can See Her Into Ruins of Everest and this, that, and the other, or whatever, modern Van Records bands, and they're like, no, I just never listened to that. It's like, how is this not being reappraised? Sorry, a lot to unpack in that question there, but Catatonia seemed to be one of the few bands that also was tapping into that kind of sorrowful, sad,
yeah,
Northern English kind of sound, you know?
Yeah, yeah, definitely. We love that. And as you say, a lot of the influence we had at the time was coming from the UK, from PL, My Dying Bride, Anathema. We thought that that was the scene that we wanted to belong to because it had, you know, first of all, a very special sound, but also, of course, the artistic side of it, the lyrics of really gloomy stuff. You know, we love that and still do, you know.
Yeah.
So definitely more kinship with that in the beginning. Yeah.
I mean, there were definitely clever people up there, up the north of England, clever musicians, clever people. I mean, whether it was when you sat in a room, I remember sitting in a room somewhere with Anathema really, really early on, like 93, 94, and the brothers were just messing around and they just sort of jammed their way in acoustics through most of Seventh Son and sang it just like off the cuff. And you're like, oh, okay, these are just proper musicians. They can,
they are. Yeah,
they can just do anything off the cuff. And the PL, you know, when you like, oh, you're talking to Aaron and Nick, and you're like, oh, right, okay, these are clever people writing clever things to say, you know.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I know what you mean. We sort of had a kind of half a foot in that kind of scene, and we went to the old Academy Studios a bunch of times. You never managed to go there, did you?
No, we didn't. I've been there.
The old one. The one in the old building in the with the downstairs basement studio and everything, like the original Academy.
I was there once when My Dying Bride was recording some album, but we never recorded there, but we were talking about it because we thought it had the original sound for this kind of music that we were doing.
It would have seemed to make sense to me. Somewhere around 96. So what album were you on in 96? It's where you're just after
Brave Murder Day, maybe.
So
yeah.
Between Brave Murder Day and Discouraged Ones or something like this, maybe, you know? But having said that...
maybe then.
But having said that, having skipped ahead a year or two there, but the sound on Brave Murder Day itself is so iconic, maybe it had to be done where you did it. You know what I mean?
Probably, yeah. Yeah, I think so, because it's such a weird album, and even the sound is weird on that, but in a good way, you know?
Yeah.
It's very... focused on being very repetitive and dark. So, but I think that would have worked as well in the Academy.
Yeah, I think so.
Well,
Mags was great. Like the basement room where they had these old like TV, like monitor channels that you could see, like speak to each other. So it was like, you were like, like something like you were, you know, like being caught on a camera, having, you know, robbing a shop or something. These old black and white cameras. Yeah. And then, and it was in the middle of a terrible estate, you know, and you would go around to just for something to do, to just go around to the shop, and there'd just be scenes of domestic violence.
Yeah.
You go to the local pub and the darts would stop in midair and everyone would turn around to look at you, and you might as well have said, hey, we're Irish, don't mind us.
Yeah.
In England in 1995 or 6 when we first went, actually 94 we first went there to mix the first album, was maybe not the best thing to...
No.
But you know, it had a really gloomy vibe, and of course Mags was great and Keith was great and all that kind of stuff. It's kind of strange that you didn't manage to record anything there, even like an EP or something, you know?
Yeah, I think we talked about it many times, but we never... I think it's also down to budgets and stuff, you know?
Yeah.
In the early days we would never have a budget that would even fly us there, you know? We had to do it in Sweden.
And so what about Dance of December Souls then? I mean, this is a... The No Fashion Records, is it finally on Spotify? It must be, no?
I think so, yeah.
Because for years, none of No Fashion's stuff was up there. You know, it was impossible to even find the reissues, but then Peaceful reissued it, right, about 2 years ago.
Yeah, they did, yeah. So it should be there. Yeah, the No Fashion thing was always a cluster of bullshit going on. There was some, you know, the label was bought from Thomas, the original guy.
Yeah, yeah, I remember him, yeah.
And and then... you know, the contracts weren't done right, so I think the label that bought the rights, they didn't have the rights to everything, and that's probably why it's not on Spotify, some of the stuff. So yeah, it was a mess, definitely.
So let's go back to this 92 to 93, 94 period. I mean, are you I never saw, because I used to collect, you know, flyers. You'd get like gig flyers, you know, from trading, tape trading, and you'd have all on my wall. I don't remember seeing you guys playing. Was it just because you didn't have a bass player, or were you playing any shows or not in round, let's say, between the demo and dance?
We played one show, and it was just the day before going to back to Unisound to record the dance album.
Right.
So that was our first show, and our only show, I think, for a long time.
Yeah, yeah.
Until actually when Brave Mother Day was released. So only one show. And we only played the three songs from the demo. And then we went off because we had some new songs, but we didn't want to play them yet.
Yeah, yeah.
For some reason.
I know what you mean. I remember we played a gig in 94 with them, Decomposed and Corpse. And we had to record these. We had five new songs. So in the end, of course, all the gear is fucked and everything's a mess and whatever. And we just went on and went, well, we've got to make a live, you know, live soundboard recording of new songs for Cacophonous Records back in the day. And we just went,
okay.
And we just went, oh, let's just play all the new songs, which no one knew.
Yeah.
Just like off the cuff. So everybody's there to see, like, oh, they're going to play some songs from the demo. Yeah. No, let's just, you know, make a teenage decision to just play not only new ones.
Yeah.
Nothing that anybody knows.
Yeah. No, we didn't want to play anything new because we didn't know the songs too well.
Yeah.
Even though we were going to record the album the next day, but it just felt right for us to do the three song because we were the opening band on that show and we were so nervous.
Yeah.
We actually made an attempt to go back home before the show, after soundcheck.
Oh, really?
but it was so far off, so we couldn't really... back home, so we had to go back to the venue and do the gig, actually.
Wow.
But I was so nervous, and I wasn't even singing. I was just playing drums on that show.
Good
memories. It was I know Edge of Sanity was supposed, they were supposed to be the headliner of that show, but and we were talking to Dan because we were going to see him the next day in the studio, so it's like, oh, it's nice, we get to see you at the show as well. But then he, I think he gave me a call on the same day or the day before the show saying like, oh, we're not going to make it to the gig because our guitar player has to go to prison because he had been drunk driving or something.
Okay.
So they couldn't make it. No, so
had,
I think
you had an opportunity there to say burnt the church and, you know,
create some
folklore about him.
Yeah. No, and I think Hypocrisy was headlining instead.
Oh, okay, right.
And there were some other bands. One band called Internal Decay, Swedish.
Oh, yeah.
And one band called Obscurity, I think. Not the old one, but another old Obscurity.
Not Damnation.
But they had a...
Damnation's Pride Obscurity, yeah.
Yeah, so it was cool happening, but very, very nervous.
But then nothing happened for a couple of years, right?
No, we didn't play any more shows until we got our first tour for Brave Mother Day.
Because that's really funny because I it's a long kind of story to unpack. But I think the final or one of the last shows on that tour was Dublin.
Yeah,
and it was upstairs in a bar where we had to make the stage. There was no stage, no proper lights or anything. Hundreds and hundreds of people. But I ended up singing like one or two songs.
I know, yeah.
Yeah, because Anders was like, I'm so tired of singing. Can you just sing songs, you know? As I had my fanciest velvet shirt and I was like, Yeah, of course, I'll sing a few songs.
Yeah.
But you left the tour after what, 3 or 4 days or something? Or
something? Yes, something like that, a week maybe.
Yeah.
Because I got a cold, had a fever, and there was no heating in the bus, and this was like November or something. And, you know, I was done. Yeah. I couldn't do it.
It's a strange environment when you first do it, especially if you do it in winter. In, as you say, the back of a shitty bus. The first time I really did it, I loved it. But at the same time, I found after 4 days, it's gone.
Yeah.
It's over.
Exactly, yeah. So I had to go home, which was a shame because I had been looking forward to this tour for a long time. And it was great, the few days I was on it. But and then Anders had to... learn how to sing all the song, learn the lyrics, and learn how to play and sing at the same time. And, I think that was a bit of a hassle, but he made it, you know.
Yeah, he did, for sure.
Yeah, and it worked.
In the woods, what a curious bunch of characters they were.
They were
so huge at the time, but nobody knew what they looked like.
Yeah.
And then they came out on stage wearing like Hawaiian shirts and jumpers and stuff. It was
short hair.
Yeah, it really, really surprised people.
Yeah, me too.
And I think it was like Voice of Destruction or something.
Yeah, South African band.
Yeah, they were okay, actually, as I remember. They were
very, they weren't too bad. They looked like Cannibal Corpse, but they sounded like something else. They were like emotional thrash death metal or something.
Let me tell you, that's my recollection of it. Let me tell you a funny story. That gig in Dublin, me and my friend and Paul from Arcane Sun and... we put that gig on, and we'd done like local bands and Chapel of Rest and Thus Defiled, and a few other people had done different shows, you know, like the demo shows for English bands who'd got the ferry across. We'd never dealt with a band and like a tour bus. We didn't really know what we were doing at all, you know, but there were hundreds and hundreds of people there, like 400 and something people or 400 people.
Yeah.
You'll probably be in the comments now going, no, it was 382 people or whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
but the night before, I remember we didn't know what to do. We didn't know what a writer was. So me and the girlfriend at the time stayed up like for hours making hundreds and hundreds of sandwiches and like all sorts of like things you give like, school kids or something, you know, we'd no clue. And we laid them all out. They were in plastic bags on this. And we said to everybody who arrived, like, oh, well, the sandwiches are just in plastic bags. And I just never forget Anders looking at me, just like, oh, God, please, some hot food. And we're like, oh, yeah.
Okay.
Oh, yeah, you should give people hot food. Just never entered our heads that you got, you know, the bands wouldn't want to eat just only cheese sandwiches in 1995 or whatever it was, you know?
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah, but I mean, it was our first tour, so we didn't know what to expect probably either. But after being on a tour for a while, and if you only get sandwiches, probably it's time to get some.
Yeah, of course. Of course, it's just the fucking arguing over what the contents were. I don't know. Will they eat cheese? I don't know. I suppose they will. Will we go? You know, just kind of like sitting up all night making sandwiches because you've no clue what was happening, you know. But you so around this time is where you stopped doing the singing and just moved to the drums for Brave Murder Day. What was behind that choice?
Because I tried to sing on the album.
It was just the... Oh, sorry.
Yeah, I think I lost the technique.
Yeah.
And I never really got it back, which is weird because I remember back in the day I didn't have a problem at all scream and do the growling stuff, but when we had finished all the recordings for Brave Murder Day and it was just the vocals left to do, and I was trying for a day or something and it didn't sound right, so I thought, you know, I'm done, you know, I don't want to ruin this album by singing like some fucking bum, you know. We called our friend Mikael from Opeth, and you know, that's the rest is history pretty much. I never really got back to growling, unfortunately.
It's weird, like I still do it now and again in primordial, but for sure the hysterical over the top almost Varg like of the early 90s that just came like blip, like that, and the volume of that went lower and the singing volume went up till now.
Yeah.
Like, and I used to look at the singing songs in the set and go, oh, fuck, okay, this is high with the singing, like singing. Now I look at the songs as the, where does his voice come from now? You know, it's just like, it's still in there, but it's gotten smaller and smaller and smaller.
Yeah.
But you just kind of felt like you'd lost it altogether or what?
Yeah, but I think maybe the voice was still there, but I couldn't recall the technique, how to do it. Mm. And I don't know why. And I've tried ever since, you know, many times, and it just don't appear anymore.
Do you remember the band from Holland called Occult? Remember, they were like black thrash band. They were pretty good.
Yeah.
The demo was killer. And they made their first album, and Prepare to Meet Thy Doom. And Sephiroth, Maurice, ended up having to record the vocals with some sort of throat pain. And I never forget, he had the harshest Vorfalek style black metal voice. But on the album, it was like, it was just nothing there, you know?
Yeah.
So I suppose, as you say, the rest is history. You made, I guess, an executive decision that turned out to be the right decision, I guess.
I think so. For us, I mean, it maybe wouldn't have worked for another band, but for us, we were already taking certain steps towards, you know, what we're doing today, actually.
But there were
some clean vocals on Bremen.
I mean, Rain Room. That's the song, isn't it? Or Day. Is it Day?
Yeah, Rain Day, Room. Yeah.
So that's...
Yeah, Rain Room has some clean vocals as well, but Day is all clean vocals.
Yeah, yeah.
And that was the first step, and it doesn't sound very pretty, but at least we thought, you know, maybe this is the way to go for us. Because I couldn't do the growls anymore. We don't want to have a guest growler on every album.
Yeah.
So just to save the band, pretty much, we decided to go for the clean vocals. And
but this was today, what was happening at the time, though. You know, I mean, you've got My Dying Bride is moving into clean vocals.
Yeah, yeah.
PL, like everybody, not even, I mean, as much as it matters, grand scheme of things, I was singing more. Lots of bands, Moonspell was singing more. Lots of bands were moving towards trying to sing. So
definitely.
So, but that small moments of Brave Murder Day, was that the first time you were trying clean singing?
Pretty much, yeah. We did.
Oh, no, hang on, you've done it. There was a bit on the demo, but that was Dan Swano, right?
Yeah, that was Dan. But we did a song, just one song called Scarlet Heavens. Yeah. The split with you guys.
Yeah, yeah.
And that was my first attempt of doing.
Okay.
But that was more of a Sisters of Mercy trying wannabe voice.
A gospel.
So, So it was different. So,
such an odd thing, though, that I just wrote a letter and went, hey, do you have a song you've never used? Hey, let's do a split. Like, that you could organize it just with like three random letters at the time. But but that song has got a Nephilim Sisters vibe. But were you sure yet that you had like a singing voice inside you, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I've probably been singing in the shower and thinking like, you know, I can pull that off. But of course, when it comes to being in a studio, it's all different. But, you know, Dan was very encouraging. I remember that and saying like, oh, you sound like Carl McCoy mixed with Andrew Eldritch. Used to be nice, probably. Yeah. But
isn't it interesting, though, because I'm a big traditional heavy metal fan, but when Primordial started to do clean vocals, there's a song on the demo and our rehearsal demo from 92. But the things I was trying to copy were Christian Death, Arcturus, My Angel. Do you remember that?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
That EP. And I was trying to do a bit of Nemesis, Day of Retribution. Ish, but my main thing was like Arcturus and Christian Death, so I took it from goth and sort of that early Arcturus, not from, I didn't want to sound like Dio, because that was like a million miles away, you couldn't do that.
So
when you were like trying to do the clean vocal, it was coming more from goth than heavy metal, really, when you think about it.
Yeah, for me, definitely, because for me, heavy metal, and still is, you know, it's connected to being great singers.
Yeah,
you know, professional range and technical abilities, and I didn't have that, and still haven't, you know. So, to me, it's more, I think later on when we did the Scourge ones, it was more Robert Smith from The Cure. But before that, it was a little bit more Sisters stuff. Yeah, actually, definitely.
You know, it was a huge influence was Monumentum, the demo of Monumentum. Yeah. The In Absentia, Museum Hermeticum demo, which is like that, the totally obscure, the split with Rotting Christ.
Yeah, super. You
know, yeah, so amazing. And that has kind of Robert Smith via black metal.
Yeah,
vocals. That demo is in my top five of that, along with the Catatonia demo, are stuck in that, shuffled in that top five of that period, you know?
That's cool. Yeah, Monumentum was such a weird band for the time.
Yeah.
Because they were doing something, I think, no one else did that.
No one. It was like, and, The Cure and black metal or something.
Yeah. And they had this... It was pretty much all clean guitars, as I remember it. But it managed to be so... Yeah. And so dark.
Yeah.
Yeah. Super dark and very captivating. Yeah. I liked it. And Roberto, the main guy, was our record label boss for many years, which was fun. And I remember us trying to say, like, you should do another Monumentum album. And he was, no.
But he didn't have the time.
Yeah, I know, but we tried to, encourage him a little bit. So, no, he's a great guy, and that's a very cool band.
Yeah,
I think.
Yeah, especially the demo. Somewhere or other, the split with Rotting Christ, which is I think one of the best 7-inches of that time. Mm. But the demo on CD or something, I think I have a, I don't know why I'm looking over there, but I think I have like, it's in like a 500-piece demo thing, but or on CD thing. But by this stage now, like what was the next tour after? Sorry, I'm trying to drag you back to the mid-90s now. The tour where you realize like, okay, like, you know, I look at a tour like with glee at the cities I go to, and I go, because I feel like I'll fucking smash this thing, and you know, just my general, you know, kind of whatever. But back when you were given, oh shit, we have 17 days in a row, and you're going, I don't know how to sing more than 4 hours in a row.
You
and you don't know what to do on stage or with your hands, or do I hold the mic? Do I not? Did you have like this? I had like an existential dread crisis somewhere in my 20s when the first ever tour was like, here you go.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, okay. I don't know.
Yeah, I think we, it took a long time until we got another tour, because I remember doing the Discouraged Ones album.
Yeah.
No touring for that. Not really, even a single show, I think.
Really? You didn't do any gigs at all?
No.
That's so weird.
Because I was still playing drums on that album, and we tried some other drummers and it didn't work out. So we didn't have a lineup for a gig. And,
right.
And then we signed to Peaceville and we released the first album with them, which is...
Decision. Yeah.
And that's when we got the chance to do our next tour. So we did, I think, the Scandinavian leg for Paradise Lost when they did the host tour.
Okay, right, yeah.
And it was just maybe 5 or 6 shows or something. And it was kind of horrifying, because I remember when I was doing the few Brain of the Day shows as a singer, you know, it was still the death metal thing. You could do the headbang. And then when we did the Tonight's tour there with PL, it was horrifying, because first of all, we were the support band. We didn't have any stage. We didn't have anything, light or anything. And all of a sudden I had to focus on the singing, and I didn't, as you said, I didn't know what to do with my hands. So it was a brutal awakening for me as being the singer.
I found that I realized the microphone stand is my shield. So like the mixture of David Coverdale and Carl McCoy, I would always hold on to the microphone stand for dear life. Because without it, my hand, I'm just like, what am I doing with this hand? Yeah. And then all of a sudden you have to learn monitors, you know, and you don't know what to do. So you're like, oh, give me a bit of this. Instead of going only singing in the, front, yeah. Please give me a handout, and can we have it here and here? You haven't a clue what you're doing, you know. And then,
no, of course,
you know. And then, so I always, first of all, I realized, like, I used to then run around to compensate. So, like, my friend is like, she's like, just stop running around. You're like, black metal Bruce Dickinson. It's ridiculous.
Yeah,
just stand still. She's like, look at Nephilim, and you know, they just stand there. And I was like, oh yeah, you can just stand still.
But yeah.
That first moment when you play that first show, where you're like, "Oh God, I need to sing this in key." Were you like super anxious about where? Where's the pitch?
Yeah,
it gives me.
Yeah, it's like, horrible.
I have sweats thinking about that first. Yeah. Oh fuck, you know.
It was horrible, and we had a Jeff Buckley cover on the album.
Oh, what?
Yeah, and
oh yeah,
and
of course. We.
And we were going to play that live as well
on
that tour. And I was like,
what's the name of that song again? That's
Nightmares by the Sea.
Nightmares by the Sea, yeah.
Yeah. And that was brutal.
What's before that? Sweet Nurse, or is that on Last Fair Deal, right?
Yeah.
That's one of my favorite songs from that record. No, that's from Last Fair Deal, isn't it? Sweet Nurse.
Yeah, it is, yeah.
It's the ninth or tenth song. Yeah, yeah, okay.
Yeah.
Like that, but it feels like this period of the band is building up to Last Fair Deal. Like, to me,
that's, it was pretty much, yeah, definitely.
It feels like, that's one of my favorite records of this period. It feels like the culmination of the previous two records, which were great, but this had one of the most, again, open, huge productions, an amazing drum sound, amazing tone, really rich tone and everything. And it just felt like, oh, right, this period has, like, because you know when you bands have different kind of periods, so do you have the first black metal period, then this kind of stuff, but that was the one that sort of went, all right, okay, this is a band that's about to take off into some other level. But was that when you felt the same thing, or the touring started, or the, you know?
No, it was pretty much the album, just I think the song,
like, Tear Gas was the, like, the hit song, kind of, wasn't it?
Yeah, that was the single song, yeah, definitely. And just the songwriting for that album was definitely stepping up. Anders was, he was working hard on the songs, and I was working hard on the vocals as well, you know, trying to improve and do some harmonies and stuff. So I think it just, everything just fell into place with that very album. And I think also that Peaceful wanted to, I mean, of course, the Tonight's Decision album, they sent us out on a tour with PL, and that was good. But I think for the next one, they really wanted to, you know, go for it with Catatonia. So we had more time in the studio, we had better budget, and it was all just a step up on the ladder.
Did you get to go to America on that one, or?
No. I think we did one show just on the Milwaukee Metal Fest. Oh, it was around that very time. Yeah.
Okay.
So the first time in America, and it was the worst gig I've ever done.
Yeah. You were stuck between, like, let's say, like Cannibal Corpse and fucking Impetigo or something. Or
yeah. And also we got sort of tricked into, because they didn't want us to bring any gear at all.
Yeah.
Because we were going on a tourist visa. And they said, just send us the specs and we'll get you the exact same stuff as you use.
Yeah.
And we did that. And of course, when we got there, there's like, oh, there's two Fender Stratocasters you can use. It's like, do you have like a distortion pedal? No, but there's some gain on the amp that you can. So it was just, yeah.
Yeah.
Because we had a lot of stuff, you know, clean guitar.
Of course.
You want to switch that, but we couldn't do that. It was just horrible, totally horrible. No sound check, no nothing.
But one thing I'm really fascinated, especially with Catatonia, is, and also with a bit with Tiamat, and I kind of see it a bit like I look at sometimes the careers of, in my, you know, of Rush and The Cure. The Cure is one of the most fascinating bands to me, that they can make Pornography, one of the greatest albums ever made, but they can also make Love Cats. And I still love Love Cats.
Yeah, me too.
They can go from this incredible seemingly contradiction between those two styles. And it took me a while after Last Fair Deal to fall in love with the Catatonia albums after that. Because, I mean, I went off somewhere other place with my listening taste. I think I went back to 1974, from 1974, to discover all the things that I'd not bothered with in the 90s that were from the 70s. Do you know what I mean? I just got super into, I don't know, Uriah Heep and Mountain and whatever else. But it took me a while then to fall back, you know, to get back into, you know, Night is a New Day and all these records. And then, but Catatonia struck me as one of those bands that somehow you managed it. A bit like Tiamat, even though they had their ups and downs, who went from Skulls and Nails and Bullets and Black Corpse Paint and managed to navigate the waters where the metal scene doesn't want to quite let you go sometimes. But you were sort of, you were allowed to move out of that, but like, you know, kind of, you know, pay homage a little bit or still be part of the metal scene.
Yeah.
But moved into some new territory. And it's not every band who gets to move like that, you know what I mean? And it always quite fascinated me with the band's career, you know, that, I don't know, did you feel like some sort of, not pressure, but like that you were moving through different musical careers? I know when you're inside the bubble, you don't really know how big a deal it is, but for people when, you know, when some of the bands they love, like adopt clean singing or other things, they fucking lose their
back. I know.
But did you feel like you were pushing against that, or you were just doing whatever you were doing? Sorry, lot of blah, 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 blah. That's the way.
I know what you mean. I think when we first made the switch, clean vocals with the Discouraged Ones album.
Yeah.
And just as you say, we were in the bubble and we thought, this sounds so good. This is the way to go.
Yeah.
And we weren't really prepared for what people would say. And we got a lot of shit for that album. And, you know, people get on with it and they either like it or they just give up on the band, which is fine with me, you know.
Yeah.
So I think we kind of quickly got into a space, as you say, we were navigating and we found a space where we felt totally comfortable doing what we were doing. And we also still had a lot of support from people. So it's been a pretty comfortable journey compared to maybe some other bands that tried to make this, to make the same journey, but you know, maybe didn't have the exact feel for what people were looking for.
Do you know what what you're saying? It fascinates me because I have the feeling that if Catatonia had gone on tour, let's say for the first album, and had come out with Leather and Corpse Paint and whatever, you'd be way more stuck in a moment because people would go, "Oh, do you remember when Catatonia used to like Samael or something?" Or whatever, and then people go, "Well, I don't like this dancing the male because we won't worship him." But because you were quite absent from the stage for years.
Definitely,
you didn't start until you were singing.
No,
so you kind of had the first chapter, which maybe would have held you a bit back into the metal scene, was kind of only musical. It wasn't the stage. It wasn't physical. Does that make any sense?
Yeah. Definitely. I mean, I think you're right because the first impressions of a band is what's going to last probably. And if people have no impressions in a live environment.
Yeah.
There's nothing to compare to. So that was probably a lucky shot for us.
Yeah. I mean, we didn't get to go on tour much, but we did play gigs in 93, 94 and then go to Europe in 97. But I was, you know, full on Double Bullet Belt, Corpse Paint, but flouncy white pirate shirt.
Yeah.
I wanted to be like Martin Ain. So it was Martin Ain via Christian Death, via Fields of Nephilim. So like a sort of black metal, I don't know, goth or something like this, you know?
Yeah, I like it.
But and you know, I mean, I still put on the stuff and whatever, but the fact was, if we then made a wholesale change into something else, people would go, "Oh yeah, but look at this. You looked like this." But you guys sort of, you didn't have that because you weren't out touring those first few records, you know?
No. That's good. That's good for us now, probably. Yeah.
But also you quite successfully managed, it strikes me as a band who managed their career business-wise, as you said, with Anders after that. Some bands mismanaged it. Like, say, for example, Tiamat. They were, like, huger than all of us. Everyone. Mm. Wild Honey.
Oh, yeah.
And somehow completely fucked it.
Yeah.
Mismanaged their entire, like, and that's a band who still should be pulling 1,000 people a night somehow, somewhere.
I think so, yeah.
But
they were definitely going, and I don't even know what happened. Because I lost them pretty much after maybe Clouds, and I wasn't really into Wild Honey, and so I haven't really checked out what they sound like a little bit, but
well, they made some good records.
To me, it's just still the same kind of stuff that they do.
Yeah,
but I don't know why they took a dive.
Isn't it interesting though how some bands manage their careers, and like say Moonspell seem to be quite good at managing their career, because none of us are selling any of the records we used to.
Well, yeah, exactly.
Well, I will say that Primordial's a bit different because the first records, I have no idea, but the records in the end, middle bit, you know, 2005 on were the ones that sold. But like we weren't hung by what was the big one from 96 or 95, like some bands. But certainly some bands seem to manage their career a bit better than us. Career, I put that in rabbit ears, you know.
It is your career, but
there's the house you bought with your career. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. No, of course. I mean, some people are more business-minded than others. And if you have one of those in your band, that's a good thing.
Yeah, definitely.
And I think Moonspell, they're bright guys, you know. They know what to expect and what they can demand, and they manage to do it.
You strike me as a man who, in all the times we've chatted and, you know, hung out and whatever, I mean, sometimes, like, you intend the music to be taken very seriously, but when somebody actually meets you in person and tells you the very serious thing that it meant to them, I feel quite awkward, and I can't, because Irish people are not very good at taking a compliment. We sort of, oh, okay.
Yeah, yeah.
Thanks. Make a joke and,
yeah,
you know, I'm awkward a little bit with this sort of when people get really, really emotional and sentimental. And so I can only imagine what it must be like for you. You must get that times five.
Yeah, and I think we're pretty much the same in Sweden. You know, when someone compliments you, it's like it will always, in my mind, be like, I'm no better than anyone else, you know.
Sure.
Don't give me that stuff. I mean, I'm just lucky enough to have made a song that appeals to you, and that's it, you know. So it's it's awkward, definitely.
What I mean is, when you write personal lyrics that are not fantasy, they're not traditional heavy metal escapism.
No.
They're more introverted. They're like, this is, you know, we're not looking outward, we're looking inward. And so sometimes people will take that so incredibly seriously. And I love it, don't get me wrong.
Yeah.
But does it ever get to the times where you just feel a little bit, not uncomfortable is not the right word, but it gets difficult when people take it quite so seriously, and then they meet you and then you don't know what to do or where to go. I feel quite
Yeah, lonely. Absolutely. I mean, absolutely. Of course, I'm flattered that people find, you know, whatever solace or and that's what I also look for in lyrics myself, you know.
Yeah,
but when someone comes up to me saying, you know, being very specific about certain things and being maybe a bit obsessive, that's uncomfortable for me. It's like that's not what I signed up for. You know, if it becomes too close, you know, I have no problem talking to people, saying thanks and hey, and you know, I like that. But when it becomes a little bit too much, it's as you say, you don't know where to go. It's like, okay.
Well, the Irish thing to do is to just make a stupid joke about it all and go,
yeah,
go on, let's have a fucking drink, and you know, hey, it's fine, yeah. Because we also have this cultural thing rolling with Primordial. So you get people who take, you know, coffin ships and the whole Irish heritage lineage famine-y, God, sorry. But some very, you know, serious people take these things. And I love it, but they get very, very, very intense sometimes, you know.
Yeah.
And we all have to go, oh, let's just do a shot of whiskey and calm it down.
Yeah, that's maybe the remedy. I'll start doing that. I will offer people whiskey when they get too close.
Yeah, because people do. And that's what I love about metal, in the sense that, like, it's the thing that I love and sort of like push back against it. In that, I remember having a conversation with Millet from Creator around the time of what's this album, Outcast, where they kind of went Endorama, where they went a bit goth.
Endorama, yeah.
It's good gothic. Songs on it. Good songs on it. A bit gothy, but we didn't need to see Millet wearing a kind of tight
shirt. No.
But I remember we were sitting somewhere at some bar, and I was blah, blah, blahing, and he just sort of said to me, like, if I didn't make this record, I couldn't make Violent Revolution, you know?
No, of course.
In the sense that metal fans take very extreme ownership of the bands that they love. Like, they take it super personally when you change the logo, you change the singing, you change the something, your haircut, whatever, you know? And I love that. But I also find I love the way that people take such incredible ownership of it. But also, for example, with Catatonia, that's a band where you've moved through so myriad changes of logo to this, that, and the other.
Yeah, yeah.
Do you ever, like, it must be hard to, or maybe it's not hard, I'm not sure. The acknowledgement that you're moving through, as I say, navigating totally different waters every time, with like the idea, like, we'll just change the logo, and then somebody goes, I have a very big problem, he'll change the logo.
Of course. Yeah, no, I think, you know, maybe 15 years ago, that was a bigger problem than...
Yeah, not now.
Right now, it feels like, you know, either people don't care anymore do, because maybe they're so attached to the music anyway, and or we don't care, because, you know, we're soon getting too old for this anyway.
You're right. It feels like something people cared a bit more at the end of the 90s, early 2000s, somehow.
Exactly.
Kind of pre Instagram DMs, it felt a bit more serious and heavy then, didn't it? Is that just our age? Is that just our age or what?
Maybe, because we or at least, you know, as I grow older, I care less about stuff, which is nice for me, because I cared about a lot of stuff back in the day. Not just what people would think about me, but also, you know, I have to do this because it's even like going visiting your grandparents, which I thought was boring. But I would do it because it's expected of me. But these days... Yeah. I would say no to that if they were alive, because I think it's boring, you know. And I think that's a good thing about getting older, because you don't have to do exactly as what's expected from you.
I think it's a process of discovering what are the things that you shouldn't give a fuck about and the things you should give a fuck about.
Yeah, exactly.
A lot of being young and approaching middle age is being confused about either or. And
definitely.
So if you think, well, on this hand, I really give a fuck about sex, drugs, and rock and roll. On the other hand, I give a fuck about singing in tune or having a voice or giving it, you know, then you're like, we're first on the bill. Who cares? I'll just power or unpower through it. And okay, let's go back to the other hand. And then as you get
the fun part.
The fun part, or whatever the other part is. And then you realize, you go, well, you know, maybe you should, this other hand should be more important. I think that's what it is.
You make better decisions, but fewer maybe when you're older.
I still make some stupid decisions.
Yeah, me too, but we all do. But at least you have a clue of what you're doing.
It's arguable, but it's true. And so, what... We're bringing this full circle. And so what do you think, you've learned anything from this pandemic break?
Yeah, I was talking to our drummer, Moyo, and we were both saying, like, you know, there's so much stuff that we've taken for granted before.
Yeah.
Like when we have stayed in the backstage in every city that we've been to. And we said now that, you know,
you go and talk to people?
I mean, it served to us, you know, every European city that you could ever dream of visiting. Yep. It's right there. And we sit in the backstage, like moping and listening to death metal. So we said, like, you know, let's broaden our horizons a little bit if we get back to touring. Visiting maybe some cultural sites, or just go to a cafe or whatever, you know. That's my main thing.
To take a bigger to take a bigger bite out of it.
Exactly. Yeah. And enjoy it more.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I have to say that, I mean, the last 10 years I've really, before all the nonsense, enjoyed it so much, and I always tried to take a bigger bite out of everything. I wasn't trying to encourage the other lads to, like, come on, get out of the backstage.
Yeah.
You know, get off the phone, let's go, and or even just it's hilarious to go and or rewarding to have chats with, go to the bar, go out with people, you know, go out or whatever. I was always very, a bit more.
Yeah, I know you're more like that, but
So it didn't affect my personality much, but the introspection of the thing I was trying to get at from the start was the idea that I liked never having a moment off. I like never having I like fucking relentless, whatever. And then it's like, oh, you've 20 months of enforced, which you're angry at. But the last few months, we kind of went, oh my God, you've been doing this for 30 years. How the fuck did that happen?
Yeah.
It's been quite a weird, calm introspection, you know? Like, have you pulled out any of your old records and gone, I listened to that and gone, fucking hell, this is way better than I remember it, or.
yeah, because we're releasing now a compilation of B-sides and bonus tracks and stuff. Mm-hmm. I think it's coming out this week or something.
Yeah.
And I had to go back to listen because some of the lyrics were missing. They weren't released anywhere. Wow. And I didn't have them because they were written on paper, as we talked about earlier.
Yeah.
And probably thrown in the bin.
Yeah, probably.
So when they were compiling this, they like, what's the lyrics to this song? And I'm like, I don't know. So I had to listen to them, some of them. Figure out the lyrics. And then I was like, wow, this is some good stuff here.
One of my favorite things is Sounds of Decay.
Oh, yeah.
This one of my favorite, my favorite few Catatonia things. That's one of the best EPs of this time, you know?
Yeah, it's definitely cool. We wanted to build on the Brave Murder Day thing. But just a little bit more PL-ish kind of.
Yeah.
Because we were, you know, still wanting to pay tribute to those guys and their sound mainly. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I should have mentioned this fucking 20 minutes ago. But how do you, like, so next year, when I do these sort of interviews, I sort of don't know what we should say moving forward, because we really don't know. You know, the Monster Energy variant could arrive and decide that we all can't do anything, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, I've said rather stubbornly on the podcast that, like, if there's no touring or traveling, I find it hard to see a reason to make heavy metal. I mean, I will make one more record or one more this or the other, but to just be a square on a screen and just only be digital and then just mooch about at home, I find, like, that's not why I started being in a band, you know. I started being in a band to be in a room with other people. And if you remove that, it starts to be functionless or humanity-less in a sense, you know?
Yeah, I totally agree. I feel the same. You know, if there's another year, another 2 years of this, that's not going to make it for me. You know, I want to be sweating.
Yeah, yeah.
Well,
we could do that, but we might have to become like farmers or like sort of organic, working at the organic market or something.
Yeah, definitely. No, you're right. It's a sad fact, but it's the same for me. Mm-hmm. I don't want to do just albums or a live stream. That sucks, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
It's boring. Suck. Yeah.
All right. So here's what we're going to do. If in 9 months' time, we're not back to like 50, 70%. We're going to start some organic market produce the project, and we're going to go back to the 1950s or the 1850s, and we're going to become farmers.
I'm on. Yeah. Count me in.
All right. Let me press stop.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.